You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. My name is Emily. Today I am talking to Bruce Gagnon, who is the coordinator of Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Bruce, thank you very much for being on the phone today.
Good to be with you.
Let's start off talking about the organization. How did this come about?
Well, for many years, I was the state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, and we were working on space issues beginning around 1983. And by the end of the 80s, it was clear that the arms race was moving very quickly into space, that the Pentagon was working very hard, along with aerospace industry corporations, to consolidate their power in Congress and their influence with the media. Things were getting very bad very quickly. And there was also a group in Colorado called Citizens for Peace and Space. Colorado Springs is where the U.S. Space Command was headquartered. And so that group and our group put our heads together and decided that we needed to create an organization that could work nationally and internationally to begin to build a wide-ranging constituency around this space issue, because until we really develop a group of people around the planet who understand the space issue and are working on it, we're never really going to be able to be successful in stopping the nuclearization and weaponization of space. So in 1992, we did create the Global Network, and I began coordinating that and have been doing so ever since.
Bruce, you come from or grew up in a military family, and at some point in your life you made that switch and became an activist and involved in issues to do with peace. What created that switch for you?
Well, that's right. I was actually a young Republican for Nixon in 1968, living up in the panhandle of Florida. My dad was a career Air Force man, and like him, I decided I wanted to be a career Air Force person as well, and during the Vietnam in 1971, I joined the Air Force. As fate would have it, I was sent to an airlift base in California for the war, and soldiers would come from all over the country to get on the planes to go to Vietnam, and when those planes would return, they would bring the body bags of the dead soldiers, and just daily they were lined up, these body bags, just across the street from where I worked, and I would see these rows and rows of dead soldiers coming back from Vietnam. And also, there were frequent protests outside the base on the weekends, and that created a dynamic inside the base in the barracks and the chow hall and on the job, where we were constantly debating the war, and it changed my life. And I actually ended up trying to get out of the military as a conscientious objector within about 9 months after I figured out what was really going on. I was not able to do so, so I ended up spending 3.5 years in what I called a hard time. And once I got out, I decided I would never, ever put myself in such a position again. And from there, I went to college, University of Florida, and just as I was ready to graduate, I was recruited to become a union organizer by the United Farm Workers Union that was organizing fruit pickers in Florida. And so I've been an organizer ever since.
When you talk about weapons and nuclear power in space, I know I tend to, and I think perhaps a lot of people tend to focus on what's going on down here, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the potential, or what the media plays up as a potential war in other parts of the world with Iran and places. And then space exploration always comes across more as something where it's just Hubble's going up to different planets or whatever they're doing up there and taking photographs. What is really going on up there that we need to be concerned about?
Well, that's a real good question. There's so many things happening. Let me just make a general statement to answer the question, then I'll get a little more specific. First of all, the Pentagon, the Space Command, say that they're working on so many different technologies today for warfare in, from, and through space. And they say, you know, we're not going to get all of them to work, but we're going to get some of them to work. Give us enough time, give us enough money, and we'll be able to be successful in what we're trying to do, they say. And I, in my experience now, more than 25 years of working on space issues, I can tell you that that's true. Let's just take an example. When the United States launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, over 70% of the weapons that were used by the U.S. military were directed to their targets by space technology. So today, all warfare on the Earth is coordinated by space satellites, military space satellites. So in one sense, we're saying today that these military satellites up there in and of themselves are space weapons. When you see these unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones as they're popularly called, that are flying over Afghanistan and Pakistan today, spying on the people and then actually firing rockets and missiles from these unmanned aerial vehicles, they're piloted by pilots, they're flown by pilots sitting back at U.S. bases in places like Creech Air Force Base outside the Las Vegas, Nevada, Tucson, Arizona, and other places in the United States. So these unmanned aerial vehicles are actually made possible by military satellites, because the pilots sitting in the United States in front of computer terminals with joysticks are flying them in what they call real time. There's a 2-second differential between the pilot sitting back in the United States at their computer and the UAV flying over Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's the only time differential between them. So they're able to do all this because of space technology. And so beyond that, the United States is now working on a whole slew of space weapons technologies to give the U.S. Space Command control of space, domination of space, and they say the ability to deny others the use of space. In fact, at their headquarters building in Colorado Springs, the Air Force Space Command, just above the doorway, has their logo that reads Master of Space. And in order to become Master of Space, they say they must have weapon systems that will allow the United States to destroy other countries' satellites, because if we could do all of this with space technology, then theoretically so could another country. And so the Space Command is saying we've got to have the ability to knock out other countries' satellites, destroy them, take them out of commission, so that we can be the master of space. So again, a whole host of these technologies under development today to enable the warfighter, as they say.
You know, there's really nothing pleasant about war under any circumstances, but from what you're describing there, it depersonalizes it even more, from the point that we no longer have the foot soldier on the ground to where it just becomes nothing more than a video game for these soldiers. So they have, I would imagine, almost no feeling or empathy for what the person that they're doing this against.
Well, it's true that they're trying to depersonalize all of this. There's no doubt about it. They're also trying to save money. They're also trying to involve directly less soldiers, so that less people get killed, so that the peace movement in the United States is less effective, because there's less concern by the American people. So it's a multifaceted reason that they're moving towards all this high-tech warfare. But what we're learning now, and this is just recently that we're learning this, that the so-called pilots that are flying these unmanned aerial vehicles or these drones are actually beginning to come down with cases of PTSD. Because unlike a B-52 bomber pilot, for example, that will fly over and drop these bombs from, you know, 25, 30, 40,000 feet, these guys that are flying these drones and watching everything with the satellite technology are actually seeing the people that they're killing on the ground. They're seeing it right in front of their eyes. And apparently they're coming down with severe cases of PTSD. So this hope on the part of the military that they were going to sanitize that aspect of the warfare is not really working for them. But clearly, you're right, they are trying to make it hands-off warfare. But our position is that the blood is still on our hands for sure. And we know for a fact, the reports have been very clear over and over globally in recent months that a high number of civilians in both Afghanistan and Pakistan are being killed by these drone attacks, again, that are all facilitated by this space technology.
A network against weapons and nuclear power in space is obviously trying to keep the public informed and also bring about a lot of changes. Are you actually getting any support from any members of Congress? The only one I'm really aware of that I've ever heard talking about stuff like this is Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Are there any others backing you?
Yeah, there's some number of members of the Progressive Caucus in Washington that do support our work, that do annually try to cut funding for the research and development of these space technology systems. There's at the UN, a treaty called Prevention of an Arms Race from Outer Space, and the China and Russia for many, many years have been every year at the General Assembly at the United Nations introducing this treaty, saying let's ban weapons in space, let's close the door to the barn before the horse gets out. And all through the Clinton years and then all through the George W. Bush years, the United States was blocking the development of that treaty at the UN. So the Democrats and the Republicans in general have been allies in moving forward these technologies. But there is a small group of people in Congress, the Progressive Caucus, that are our allies, but it's a very small group. And not enough power, I'm afraid, to take on the control that the aerospace industry, that the military-industrial complex has of the Congress of the United States. There's no doubt about it that the vast majority of Congress, Republicans and Democrats both, are under the control of these corporations.
And is that because they basically were put in office by them? They were funded by them?
That's right. In the last election, in this just recent election where Obama was elected, he received more money from the weapons industry than John McCain did. The Democrats that ran for Congress received more money from the weapons industry than the Republicans did. That was the first time in the country's history. And so it's very clear that the weapons corporations took a look at the polling data and said, it looks like the Democrats are going to win. The American people are tired of the Bush years. Let's invest in the Democrats, and they invested heavily, and now they're getting what they want. Obama has already asked for and gotten from the Democratic-controlled Congress a 4% increase in military spending for 2010. Today, the United States is spending more on the military than the rest of the world combined. Every other country in the world, when you add up what they're spending on the military, the United States is spending more than all of them combined.
When did that huge increase start?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know in recent years that trend has been there, that we've been outpacing everyone. But I'm not sure. I can't tell you the exact year.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, are you seeing any promising signs with Obama? I know we're seeing he seems to be making some good moves, and then there's other moves that we're not happy about. I think he recently announced that he was going to scrap plans that George Bush had to deploy defense interceptors in Poland.
You know, this has been one of our top issues in the last couple of years, is trying to block these deployments of so-called missile defense systems. As you said, George W. Bush wanted to put 10 interceptor missiles in Poland and a Star Wars radar facility next door in the Czech Republic. And Obama just announced the other day that he was not going to move forward with those two systems. But what people don't know is that he then, with the other hand, said that actually I'm going to deploy in even more European countries another missile defense system that has actually been having quite a bit of success in the test phase. The system that George W. Bush wanted to deploy, the missile defense system, is the one that was having a very bad success rate in their testing program. Its job was to try to hit a bullet with a bullet way up in deep space where missiles are already at full speed and they can fire decoys, and it's virtually impossible to hit them. The program that Obama is saying that we're going to move forward with is what's called boost phase missile defense. The idea there is that you don't wait until the missile gets way up into deep space. You put the interceptors nearby the so-called ascending nation so that as soon as they try to launch, as their rocket is taking off, it's very slow, it's very visible because fire is coming out of the engines. It's not yet in deep space and it can't fire decoys, so it's an easier target. And so the missile defense systems that have been developed to hit something in its boost phase are having tremendously successful testing program. For example, the Aegis destroyer, it's a U.S. Navy destroyer, has been outfitted with these missile defense systems. These ships are actually made where I live in Bath, Maine, at a place called Bath Ironworks, a shipyard. These missile defense systems have tested out 15 kills in 18 tries. And then another system called THAAD, a Theater High Altitude Defense System run by Army, the Army put on mobile launchers, is 6 for 6 in their testing program. So Obama, as he said, we're not going to deploy the Bush variety, said we are going to deploy these boost phase systems. People aren't talking about that. There wasn't much press about that. Most people, even in the peace movement, don't know that Obama has just essentially done a shell game. And then just since that time, since that announcement last week, the Czech Republic defense minister is saying that they've been told by the United States that we're still going to be deploying some of these missile defense systems in their country. So no real change here at all. And Russia, of course, is concerned about this because the United States recently, working with NATO, has been encircling Russia. Now, people would say, why is the United States wanting to militarily encircle Russia? Well, as it turns out, Russia has the world's largest supply of natural gas and significant supplies of oil as well. And anyone that's paying any bit of attention knows today that the official U.S. military strategy is try to control the declining stocks of fossil fuels around the world today. That's what the U.S. military has become, a oil protection, oil and natural gas protection service for the big corporations. And that's why we're expanding our military empire now to about 1,000 bases around the world, trying to control the extraction and shipment of all fossil fuels. And so recently the United States has built military bases in Bulgaria and Romania, and NATO is expanding right up to Russia's border with bases in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and now we want to put bases in Georgia. And in fact, just in recent days, I've seen reports that the United States might be wanting to put a Star Wars radar system right on Russia's southern border in Georgia. So Russia is very concerned about all of these deployments. And what they're worried about is that this, in fact, has nothing to do with defense whatsoever. It has nothing to do with intercepting missiles from Iran. It's all about developing a first strike capability against Russia, so that as the United States theoretically launches a nuclear missile or attack on Russia, they try to fire their retaliatory capability. You then have these so-called missile defense systems that then take out their retaliatory capability. And so the U.S. is not just now militarily encircling or surrounding Russia. We're doing the same thing to China with these missile defense deployments on these ships, these naval Aegis destroyers. They're being home ported in Australia, Japan, and South Korea, very near China's coast. And these SPAD interceptors, these Army interceptors, are also being put into Korea and Japan. Again, their job will be to intercept Chinese missiles after a U.S. first strike. Now, some people would say, oh, come on, Bruce, you're getting a little paranoid here. The United States would never launch a preemptive first strike attack on another sovereign nation. But, of course, that's exactly what we've done in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that is now official U.S. military policy today, developing first strike capability.
Now, the countries you mention, Japan, South Korea, Russia, and these are very powerful countries, so they're not going to take being bullied and pushed around lying down. I mean, they're not a small, fairly weak country the way Iraq was, although they fought back quite strongly. But what do you see happening if the United States continues to try and impose themselves and put bases all over the place?
Well, in the case of Japan and South Korea, Japan just had a change in government, but their right-wing government that they've had for a really ever since World War II, they had the same party, right-wing party in power. They've been going along very gladly with the United States' aggressive moves in the region. You have to remember that Japan was a colonial fascist power that invaded and occupied South Korea and China prior to World War II and then during World War II. So Japan still has really strong elements of this fascist, right-wing, colonial, imperialist strain in their country today. The recent election of a little bit more a liberal party, Democratic Party of Japan, still has very strong conservative elements even within that party. So they're not going to ask the United States to leave. They're not going to ask the United States to take our missile defense systems out of their country. In fact, they're now becoming partners in the program. In South Korea, they have a right-wing government that is an ally of the United States, and they too are very glad to have the United States expanding its military in the region. In the case of China and Russia, that's another story. Both those countries are very, very concerned, very opposed to the United States' aggressive military moves surrounding them. And in fact, Mikhail Gorbachev, who most people remember, was a former president of the Soviet Union before it collapsed, in a speech last April in Rome to an anti-nuclear conference said, if you think there's going to be serious anti-nuclear negotiations between the United States and Russia, then you have another thing coming, because as long as the United States is expanding NATO deployments, encircling Russia, is expanding its missile defense deployments, and is continually expanding both its conventional and nuclear arsenal, there's no way that Russia will be able to seriously agree to get rid of a lot of their nuclear weapons, because they just can't afford to do it. With that, all those dynamics going on. And so, as we hear Mr. Obama just this week at the United Nations calling for nuclear abolition and all these other things. Now, that's great talk, but if you're at the same time expanding your military budget, expanding your missile defense deployments throughout Europe, beginning this encirclement of Russia, and then creating more space technologies, it's very difficult for Russia then to agree to these any kind of real serious reductions. There might be some minor nuclear agreements made, but nothing to really get rid of nuclear weapons as long as the United States is becoming this imperial power around the world.
You were just recently in Japan and South Korea. What was the outcome of your visits there?
I went on a month-long speaking tour, 3 weeks in Japan and 1 week in South Korea, and then I'm actually going back to South Korea on October 6th for 3 more weeks. That part of the world is becoming really, really militarized right now, as the United States is essentially doubling its military presence in that region, in the Asian Pacific region. Peace activists in Japan and South Korea are just working their tails off trying to stop this major, major U.S. Deployment of all kinds of military in throughout the region. but particularly in their two countries. Their two countries are being used to just absolutely expand dramatically the U.S. military presence in the region, all directed at China. Now, the American people are told it's all being directed against North Korea. North Korea has a pipsqueak military. North Korea has an outdated military that is old and out of fashion and out of technological development. And but we use North Korea and the fact that they have developed a little bit of rocket technology, and they now have very few, literally a handful of nuclear weapons. We use that as the public rationale, the excuse that we're doing all this massive military buildup in the region, but that's really not the reason. The reason is because of China. The United States is, encircling China, and the reason why is because the U.S. recognizes that China is now becoming a massive economic competitor, such that the U.S. won't be able to compete with it economically anymore. And so the U.S. has decided that the way we're going to handle China is by trying to control them militarily, by trying to surround them militarily, and thus dictate, if you will, terms to them. You're going to do this, you're going to do that, and if you don't, we're going to take you out. In fact, every year for the past 10 years or so, the U.S. Space Command has been computer wargaming, an attack on China set in the year 2016. They call it the Red Team versus the Blue Team. And in that war game, the United States launches a preemptive first strike attack on China using a new system that they're calling the military space plane. If you've been listening very closely, you've heard NASA lately saying that we've got to replace the shuttle, the space shuttle. It's an outdated technology. Well, the replacement is going to be the military space plane. It's going to take off like an airplane, fly through orbit, through space, and get to the other side of the world in 1 hour. And in that computer war game, the United States launches its first strike attack using the military space plane. It takes off, flies through space, drops this devastating attack on China. Now, China today admittedly has 20 nuclear missiles that are capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. And in this computer war game, the United States, with these military space planes, tries to take out as many of those 20 nuclear missiles as possible. But a few of them are left after that first strike. And in this war game, China then fires them in retaliation. And it is then that these missile defense systems on these Navy Aegis destroyers, these ships, and these ground-based systems that are being deployed in Japan and South Korea throughout the region, encircling China's coast, they then try to take out China's retaliatory capability in this first strike attack. China is very aware of this war game. They're very aware of all these developments that the United States is making in the region. And they're saying, look, we've got a lot of hungry people in our country. We're trying to feed people. We're trying to develop ourselves economically. We'd rather not get into an arms race with the United States. But we can't just sit back and watch you do all this and not respond. We're having to respond. And so they are having to build up their military, not nearly at the rate we are, not nearly at all, but they are building up in a defensive way to try to protect themselves against this massive U.S. military mobilization that's going on in the Asian Pacific region.
Where is Russia on this right now?
Well, Russia is creating a pact with China. They've created a pact called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is both a military and an economic alliance, where they're saying, we can't let the United States think that they're going to run this part of the world. In fact, just this week I wrote a blog. I do a kind of a daily blog that you can access through our website. I should have mentioned our website already. It's spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. And if you go to our website, we talk about all these different issues that I've been talking about here, but also we link to my blog, which is called Organizing Notes. But anyway, this week on my blog, I wrote about Mongolia. I didn't even know about this until I got an email from an American woman teaching English in Mongolia. She saw an article I wrote recently, and she said, "Do you know about what the United States is doing in Mongolia?" And frankly, I didn't. Well, we're building up their military like crazy. We're now sending our troops over into Mongolia. We're helping Mongolia build all kinds of military bases and everything else, and we're leaving equipment and leaving our troops there more frequently. Well, the important point is the location of Mongolia. Mongolia sits right between Russia and China. It borders both those countries. And so the United States is now basically setting up another military operation right between those two countries. Now, it would be the equivalent of Russia or China setting up military bases in both Canada and Mexico and Cuba at the same time. Well, you remember how the America reacted during the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 60s when Russia put some nuclear missiles into Cuba. We almost went to nuclear war over it. Get them out of here. This is our backyard. Don't you dare come in here with those things. And Russia did. They took them out, and they've never, ever tried to do anything like that again. They recognized that this was, you know, America's backyard, and that was a dangerous thing to do. But we're doing the reverse to Russia and China today, and most people don't even know anything about it. Most people in America don't even know it's happening.
You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio in Sarasota. My guest today is Bruce Gagnon from the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. We're going to take a short music break, and then I will be back talking to Bruce. And you can also visit the website, which is space4peace, just the number 4.org, and that gives a lot more information on the organization. Bruce, we've talked about the militarization of space and how the United States is racing to have control over what is inevitable, that we are going to explore further in space and off this planet with technology advancing. Are there any other, I mean, I know we've just pretty much destroyed or are destroying our planet. We're running out of resources. Do you know if part of this race is to try and have control of any resources that might also be found up in space or on other planets?
Oh, that's absolutely true. Some years ago, I read a book called Mining the Sky by a NASA scientist who said there's gold on the asteroids, there's magnesium and cobalt and uranium on Mars. You've probably heard about the little rovers that are driving around Mars.
Yes.
Supposedly looking for, what, the origins of life or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, really what they're doing is they're doing soil identification and sampling because they believe there's magnesium, cobalt, and uranium there, and there are plans to go there someday and mine Mars. In fact, Halliburton Corporation, that most people have heard of because of the Iraq War, has built a drilling mechanism for mining on Mars. On the moon, they say there's helium-3, which could be used for fusion power back here on Earth, making the profits of oil corporations, they say, look like nothing in comparison. And so now there's a race to get to the moon. Who's going to control the moon? And so the nuclear industry is every year meeting for the past 20-some years, meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, every February. I've been there many times, protesting outside when they have this big conference where they're planning nuclear-powered bases on the moon and Mars and other planetary bodies, nuclear reactors powering mining colonies, nuclear rockets in order to get us to these planetary bodies, having heavy lift capability to bring back resources from these planets. It's amazing all the things that are going on and the developments. And you, the taxpayer, are paying for all of this right now. NASA, we're told, is, again, out there looking for the origins of life and everything else. But in fact, no, they're not. They are a research and development agency for these corporations, for these aerospace corporations who want to go mine the sky NASA's job is to create the technologies that will allow that to happen. And legislation has been written and introduced into Congress, not yet passed, to saying that when the day comes, when they can turn a profit, when they can begin mining the sky profitably, that they want to make it all tax-free. So after you, the taxpayer, paid all the years of research and development, you paid for the technologies to be created to make this all possible, when the time comes that they're going to turn profit, these corporations don't even want to pay taxes on it. So the ripoff continues.
I'm not a scientist by any means, but you mentioned magnesium, cobalt, and uranium. My understanding, at least of cobalt and uranium, those are not things that would be beneficial to feeding the masses on the planet or healing people. Those are things that would... Uranium, is that not used for nuclear power? So
that's
basically
right.
What they're wanting to mine up there is nothing that's really going to benefit us. It's going to benefit the nuclear industry.
Well, you know, I think that's basically true. You know, it's all about their industrial production system, which is all based on profit and greed and destruction of the planet. You know, the Mars Society, an organization that is calling for the Congress of the United States to pay for the terraforming of Mars. Do you know what that means, the terraforming of Mars? It means taking the dry, dusty, lifeless red planet of Mars and changing it into a green, beautiful, life-sustaining planet. Well, can you imagine how much money it would cost to terraform Mars? And the Mars Society says, well, we've got to do this because the Earth is a rotting, dying, stinking planet. We have to move off it into Mars. My response is, well, why don't we use the money that we would waste terraforming Mars to clean up our own planet? Well, you know, why aren't we using those monies instead of trying to build a Star Wars warfighting system in space? Why don't we use that money to create a solar society back here on the planet? Why don't we build wind turbines with those resources? Why don't we build the world's greatest public transit system connecting every corner of America, getting us out of our gas-guzzling and polluting cars? So why don't we call for those things rather than moving off the planet to Mars? It just makes no sense at all.
We've talked about what the United States is wanting to do in space. I suppose it's a very hard question, but do we, and also governments lie, but to your awareness, are any of these other countries, like Russia, China, interested in doing anything positive in space, or is everyone geared on the same path for control and looking for resources?
Well, for years there's been an effort at the United Nations to try to regulate the reality of space, the inevitability of space travel. Back in the early 70s, the Moon Treaty was created that said no country can claim ownership of the moon, no corporation can claim ownership, no individual can claim ownership. Anything that is done on the moon has to be done in a unified way, you know, everyone on Earth working together. And the United States never signed that treaty because we always, ever since the 50s, I have now no longer secret, but at that time in the 1950s, a secret army study talking about U.S. military bases on the moon. It's long been known that whoever controls the moon militarily will control who can get on and off the planet Earth because of a thing called the Earth-Moon gravity well. It's the moon's in a prime position to essentially control the top of the well, who can get in and out of the well. So, you know, right now, today, though, there's a lot of countries, China, India, Japan, a whole host of countries that are doing moon missions because everyone is recognizing that this helium-3 on the moon is going to be a tremendous resource. And so there are some of us in the world that are saying, look, let's regulate this process. You know, let's create a process that, you know, we move off this planet in a unified way. You know, when you look from space down to the Earth, you see that we all live on this planet together. You know, this division of countries is an artificial construct. It makes no sense. So, you know, we're a tiny, tiny little satellite spinning through orbit this little planet Earth, and instead of shooting at each other and ripping each other's throats apart, we need to really be coming together and working together. So one thing we're trying to do in the global network is create a discussion about a whole new consciousness that is needed, that is absolutely necessary if we're going to survive, not only on this planet, but if we're going to move off this planet into space. We have to do it with the right attitude. You know, I call it right now the bad seed. You know, we're taking this bad seed of war and greed and environmental degradation that we've sown into the depths of this Earth. We're now trying to take that with us into space, and I think it's a colossal mistake. So we have to, you know, begin to have a discussion on Earth about what kind of seed do we carry into space when we inevitably go out there.
Bruce, you've been an activist for so many years, and you've obviously watched the progression of people's awareness and willingness to stand up and resist or fight or demand change. I don't mean fight in the violent word, but in a way of trying to bring about positive change. I was just watching some clips on YouTube, I think it was, of the G20 summit and the weaponry that the police are using. They had some kind of thing, I think they call it a sound cannon, and you know, they're armed up to the hilt. They're basically subhuman at that point because they're hidden behind shields and weighed down with so much weaponry. Do you see that from the years from when you first started becoming actively involved until now, that it's becoming, obviously it's becoming harder to protest or make your voice heard? Do you think we're going to be able to reverse that?
I think it's difficult. A couple years ago, I was watching C-SPAN one evening, and I saw a three-hour presentation by a man by the name of Thomas Barnett, who wrote a book called The Pentagon's New Map. And he was introduced in that occasion as Donald Rumsfeld, who was then Secretary of Defense, as his strategy guy. And in this presentation, he said that under corporate globalization of the world economy, every different country is going to have a different role. He said China is going to make things, India is going to do certain things, some other, Indonesia is going to do certain stuff. He said we're not going to have jobs in America anymore. We're not going to build cars. We're not going to make clothes or shoes or refrigerators. He said our role in America under corporate globalization will be security export. And it's no coincidence today that our number one industrial export product is weapons. And he went on to say that there are parts of the world that today are not submitting to the authority of corporate globalization. He called it the non-integrating gap. And he said our role then in the future, America's role, will be to go into the non-integrating gap and suppress them and to control them into compliance with corporate globalization. And then he named this non-integrating gap. He said it's the Middle East, where of course we are in Iraq today. It's Central Asia, where of course we are in Afghanistan today. It's Africa, where he said we will be fighting 20 years from now for their oil, because places like Nigeria and other African countries have oil, and there are a lot of other resources on the African continent. And recently the Pentagon has created a new military command called Africa Command, or AFRICOM. And then finally, he said parts of Latin America are part of this non-integrating gap. Venezuela, for example, that has a lot of oil, refuses to allow the U.S.-British oil corporations control them, so they're seen as outside of the corporate globalization system. And so what we're seeing then is a declining economic base in America, because when you don't make anything anymore and all you do is make weapons, that means you're going to have more unemployment, you're going to have less tax base, you're going to have declining social progress, and you're going to have more of an angry, outspoken, outraged citizenry, as we're beginning to see now in America. And so the strategy of the power structure then is to, first of all, try to repress the American people when they when they stand up in reaction to all of this. But secondly, their strategy, and we've seen this recently around the healthcare issue, is to try to pit one part of the country against each other by calling those that want, like single-payer healthcare, calling us communists or socialists and things like that, and trying to create this divide, almost recreate, if you will, the Civil War system in America. And so by dividing and conquering the American people. So I think we're getting ready to enter a very, very difficult period in this country. And the most important thing that can happen right now is that the American people begin to understand, first, what's going on, and then, secondly, understand how the corporations have taken control of both political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and use them, all right, to keep the American people divided against each other. The Democrats are under the control of these corporations, and too many citizens in America, too many progressive people, people that call themselves liberals, still think that the Democratic Party is going to do something good for us. It's not. It's under the control of these corporations. So we have to get out of bed with these Democrats so that we can be critical of them. Otherwise, we're not going to see any real change in America today.
So interesting. Turn people's attention away from the government and just pit the masses against each other. To end on a more positive note, what do you see as a viable future outcome rather than the path that we're actually going on?
Well, everything I've said is now being put into motion, but it is not all finally in place, let's put it that way, whether it's technology, whether it's corporate fascism. So there is still an opening for us, but we don't have a lot of time to be sitting around waiting for some president or some political party to bail us out. It's not going to work that way. And so I think the most important thing that the progressive community can do today is to begin to articulate an alternative, transformative vision of the future. Because I think there are a lot of people that really care and that really want to see some real change and that really want to help, but they don't really know who to believe or what to do or what the future could look like. And so I think we have to talk about the conversion of the military-industrial complex. We have to talk about this idea of defunding the military and taking that money and creating jobs in America, building things that we really need. Earlier I talked about a solar society, wind turbines, a mass transit system. Well, interestingly, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst Economics Department did a study in late 2007 on this very question. And they said, if you take $1 billion and you invest it in military production, you get 8,500 jobs per $1 billion. But they said, if you take that same $1 billion and you invest it in building mass transit systems connecting, you know, all over America, you create 19,000 jobs for every $1 billion invested in rail. So which would you rather have, 8,500 jobs doing military production or 19,000 jobs per $1 billion building rail? Well, I think the answer is quite easy. Americans are job scared today. We're worried about jobs. Where are we going to get jobs? How are we going to get jobs? Well, this is the way to do it, by converting the military production system to an alternative, sustainable technological system. It will also help solve the problem of climate change, which is a real crisis, which does have to be addressed immediately. All right, this is where we should be putting our attention and our resources, not on military solutions to the problems that we have today.
And do you think that that is something that we might start seeing happening, where people actually rise up enough?
It will only happen if we begin demanding it. And sadly enough, not enough of us are talking about it and politically demanding it today. Again, too many people are relying on the Democrats to do the work for us. And as we're now seeing, whether it's on healthcare or climate change or virtually Afghanistan, virtually any issue that we talk about today, the Democrats are letting us down over and over again. And it's because the progressive community is much too acquiescent today, much too quiet, much too laid back, waiting for the politicians to do it for us. We can't wait. We've got to stand up today, and we've got to speak out loudly. We have to make demands. We're talking about the future generations now. We've got to do something today to make sure that the future generations have a chance.
Bruce, you have coming up in October the International Week of Protest to Stop the Militarization of Space. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, every year in October we hold a week. We call it Keep Space for Peace Week. And we ask local groups and local activists all over the world to organize in their local communities events educating people, helping to raise consciousness about what the plans are for an arms race in space, and to offer the solutions to this growing problem of militarizing space and using space technology to fight and control the wars on the earth below. And so if you go to our website at spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, you'll see all kinds of information, posters that can be printed off and hung up in your community. And also you'll see a list of the actions that are being planned around different cities around the world today.
On an ending note, is there anything you would like to say?
Just thank you very much for having me on. And I will just urge people to do something. If you go to our website, in the menu, our website menu, there's a section called Space Videos. Go there and watch some of our videos where we tell the whole story. One of them is called Arsenal of Hypocrisy. It tells this whole story of what the U.S. plans are for control and domination of space. Get other people to look at these videos. Help us spread the word. We've got to educate people about these issues and then move them into action. And most importantly, don't give up. Keep plugging away. Find something that you can do every day, even if it's make a phone call, write a letter, send somebody some emails about these things. But do something every day to help make this world a better place for your children and your grandchildren and the future generations.
Bruce, thank you so much for talking to us today. You do a fantastic job, and keep up the good work. We really, really appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you for the help in getting the message out, Emily. It's really appreciated by all of us at the Global Network. Thank you so much.
Thank you.